So this is a talk about a project that's be released pretty shortly. So I'll joint work with Alexander Doan, who's at Columbia and Trinity, at least for now. This project has kind of been funny. I'm a sort of symplectic geometer of the thinking really deeply about J. Holomorphic curves variety, at least initially. And I really wanted to think about a PDE that was not the holomorphic curve equation. And I really wanted to think about some kind of mirror symmetry that wasn't 2D mirror symmetry. And so that's why I started thinking about this stuff. Let's just dive into it. So basically, everyone here, I think, knows what a symplectic manifold is. It's a manifold equipped with a non-degenerate two-form that's closed. And you have to, if you want to study the geometry of this manifold, we often do that by picking a compatible, almost complex structure, which makes this metric into a near this manifold into a nearly Kähler manifold, and that gives it a metric, so you can actually do kind of Riemannian geometry. But you try to study things which don't depend on that complex structure, sort of intrinsic symplectic geometry, whatever that should be. And sometimes a lot of the analysis is a lot easier when the complex structure is integrable and coherently constant in this case, and that's a Kähler manifold. But there aren't quite as many Kähler manifolds as there are nearly Kähler manifolds. There's like this infinite dimensional space of almost complex structures for any symplectic manifold, but the Kähler things are a complex structure is integrable, so they live in finite dimensional families. And what people tend to do is, there's a basic kind of interesting submanifold of a symplectic manifold, which is just a Lagrangian submanifold on which the symplectic form restricts to zero. And we try to study invariants of these, see if they exist, and so forth. Okay. So an interesting question that's sort of like a meta question is, you might want to try to complexify symplectic geometry in some appropriate way. And it's not a precise question. It's like kind of a direction. And so there's several different options which are popular. It's not clear what exactly is the best answer. So one answer is that there's you take a two-n-dimensional complex manifold with a two holomorphic two-zero form, which is non-degenerate, and closed. And this is a holomorphic symplectic manifold. And this kind of thing is like great if you're an algebraic geometer, because of course, instead of taking a complex manifold, it could have taken a variety over like a finite field, and all these definitions still make sense. And these things have a kind of natural notion of a good submanifold, which is a complex Lagrangian submanifold, which is a complex submanifold in which the symplectic form restricts to zero. And these are great, but from a kind of Riemannian geometry perspective, there's no metric. And a lot of intuition we have really comes in the end from Riemannian geometry, so this is a little disappointing. So there's like a much stronger notion, maybe kind of similar in flavor, just where you actually have a metric, and the holonomy of that metric, the Relativita connection for that metric, is an SPM, compact symplectic group. That's a hyper-Kähler manifold. So, that's a lot of people here also think about these. There's like triple of almost triple of complex structures, I, j, and k, a triple of compatible symplectic forms, omega I, omega j, omega k, and all of them give the same metric. And the complex structures satisfy the usual quaternionic relation that I wrote on the right here. And, for us, we're always going to think of some like distinguished background complex structure, which is going to be I. It's always going to be I. And in that case, if you like look at omega j plus I omega k, this is going to be capital omega, which is a holomorphic symplectic form with respect to I. And so, hyperkähler manifolds are like holomorphic symplectic in many different ways. They're kind of very rich. And the unfortunate problem is that, there's not that many hyperkähler manifolds. I mean, all the ones that we have are really cool, but I, j, and k have to be integrable. In fact, it's kind of hard to relax the conditions for a hyperkähler manifold to like drop these sort of automatic integrability assumptions on the complex structures. So there's an interesting lemma which you can prove, which is that if you have a closed, if you have just a complex manifold and like a closed two-zero form, which is non-degenerate, then the complex structure is integrable. So it's kind of, you want to like weaken all these conditions maybe to have more examples, and it's a little bit hard. So that's frustrating, I think, to a symplectic geometer who is like very, we're very used to these sorts of like flexible, floppy things. We're used to like doing surgeries along Legendrian knots and so forth, and that's a little bit harder to do in the usual integrable context. Okay. So one thing I want to advocate for is that we should try to think about, well, if you have a hypercalor manifold, then you should get some kind of Fleur theoretic invariance, the correct Fleur theoretic invariance associated to this manifold. And then in any given case, we can ask, what are the weakest conditions for which these Fleur theoretic invariance make sense? And then that's going to give us some natural weakening of the notion of a hypercalor manifold. And then we should try to study the intrinsic geometry of these structures. So for example, that's one way that you might kind of invent symplectic geometry from like the sort of supersymmetric 2-0 field sigma model. You're just trying to see what's like the weakest thing you need to make stuff work. Okay, so I said holomorphic Fleur theory. So let me quickly remind you of how symplectic Fleur homology works, or in this case, Lagrangian Fleur homology for a classical symplectic manifold. So if you have two Lagrangians, L0 and L1, then there's the path space, the paths from L0 to L1, which are all going to be gamma. And then there's this, you can integrate a two form along a path to get a one form on the space of paths. And that thing, that one form, should be thought it's closed because the original two form was closed. And this closed one form, you should be thought of as kind of the differential of some action functional, at least on some covering space. So denoting a dA, and it has some natural family of perturbations given by adding the integral of a function along the path, which are kind of the Hamiltonian perturbations of this one form. Okay. So if the symplectic form is exact, then that's when this one form is exact. And if you choose an almost complex structure that's on your symplectic manifold, that makes the path space into a Riemannian manifold by just kind of integrating the inner product along tangent vectors along the path. And the gradient flow of this one form is the Fleur equation, which, if there's no Hamiltonian perturbation term, is this holomorphic curve equation like this. Okay. And the Morse complex of this functional is called the the Hamiltonian Fleur, sorry, it's called the Lagrangian Fleur homology of these two Lagrangians. And this is, an invariant that's been studied for a long time, and it's sort of the first invariant in a very rich categorical story, which has ended up having like both connections to physics and obviously like actual applications to kind of more classical questions of symplectic geometry. Okay. So no questions maybe so far. I don't know. Feel free to ask whenever. So how do you compute this invariant, this Fleur this homology of this infinite dimensional function? Well, what Fleur kind of gave the basic wet method is you find some finite dimensional model. Maybe it's some adiabatic limit argument. So what Fleur proved in this kind of paper, Witten's complex on infinite dimensional Morse theory, is that if you have a C2 small Morse function on a manifold Q, then if you take the two Lagrangians given by the zero section and the graph of the differential of the function, then the Morse complex of that function is the same as the Fleur complex of these two Lagrangians. And the way you prove this is by doing something geometric. You write down an explicit bijection between the moduli spaces of solutions to this Fleur equation with these two boundary conditions on the two Lagrangians and the gradient flow of the Morse function. So you kind of, what this really is, it says that if you have two nearby Lagrangians, then at least all the strips in the small neighborhood are actually just kind of any Lagrangian is a graph of the differential of a function over the other. They're close by. And so, maybe of one form, I don't know, any exact Lagrangian. And so this gives you a model for all the small holomorphic strips. So that's sort of the geometric content. And, souped up versions of this kind of underlie all the computations. There's like this, plus occasionally you write down an explicit holomorphic disk, plus you have all this algebraic structure associated to Fekaya categories. And that's more or less, I think, how we get all our computations. Okay. So let's see what happens if we have a complex symplectic manifold. So we've complexified the real symplectic form to a complex symplectic form. So what's the setup? We have M, I, omega, this holomorphic symplectic manifold, and you have two complex Lagrangians. Remember, these are I complex submanifolds, and omega restricts to zero. So then the path space is an infinite dimensional complex manifold, and the action functional becomes the real part of a complex action functional, which can actually be checked to be a holomorphic function on the path space. Okay. And what this complex action functional is just the usual thing. You integrate the two form over the path. At least that's its differential. So if omega, capital omega, was d lambda, also a complex one form, then this complex action functional would actually be a function. Okay. In general, you can think of define omega theta to be the real part of e to the I theta of its complex symplectic form. And these are all just, then the corresponding symplectic action functionals are just the real parts of like e to the I theta times this complex action functional. And in this setting, the floor homology of these two Lagrangians, so these are Lagrangians with respect to any one of these symplectic forms of omega theta, kind of normal Lagrangians, and the floor homology for every one of these floor groups simplifies dramatically. And the reason for this is because, well, the basic reason is you can take the critical value, the critical points of this complex action functional are just the intersection points of these Lagrangians. They're the same as the critical points of any one of these real action functionals. And you can take any gradient flow line of e to the I theta times this complex action functional and project it and look at its image under the complex action functional, and it'll be a line. And it'll be a line in the direction theta. And it's very unlikely that given two points on the complex plane, there's a line between them with angle theta. So that tells you that for a generic theta, this Fleur complex has no differential because there are no J theta holomorphic strips. There's some of them for which there are strips. They're interesting and meaningful. But, you know, there's the story in symplectic geometry. You can always, like, move the complex structure a tiny bit, and that's not compatible, but it's tame, so that's still a valid complex structure with which to compute the Fleur homology. And so this tells you that the differential always vanishes. And that what I said makes sense if the two Lagrangians intersect transversely, and the second kind of the Fleur homology was all defined in that setting. This is like a real proof that the Fleur complex is just the sum of the intersection points. And this is the motivation for kind of Joyce's model, like in the case of, well, the two Lagrangians intersect non-transversely, then this Fleur homology group should just be some perverse sheaf group, at least on dimensions of it. And then, you know, there's some analytic results. Even if Lagrangians intersect highly non-transversely, you can still show that there's no J theta holomorphic strips for generic theta. Those are kind of a little more challenging results. But this is a depressing answer from the perspective of a Fleur theorist, because what we've said is that the Fleur homology never sees any interesting holomorphic strips. Maybe it's a great answer if you're an algebraist, because then you can go forth and forget about symplectic geometry and do perverse sheaves all day. But that's, you know, maybe we want to do something with these strips. Okay. So that's kind of why I started thinking about this. I was like, these strips have got to mean something. So one way to come up with an answer is to ask a more basic question, which is very old, which is, what is complex Morse theory? So an idea, this is, again, not my idea in any sense, is that to a complex Morse function, you should associate a category, just like to a real Morse function, you associate a vector space. The objects of this category should be critical points. The morphisms should be gradient flow lines of the real parts of this complex function. And it's like all of them. If you have two critical points, you know, there's only one theta for which there's a gradient flow line, so you should try to count that one. And the composition should be counting some kind of complex gradient flows. And what that means is like an equation like this, dsu plus idtu, so that's a kind of complex derivative, is equal to the gradient of one of these functions. And this, you know, because w is holomorphic, you can just write like gradient of real part is I times the gradient of the imaginary part. So this is really an equation for a Hamiltonian Fleur plane. Like, it's a Hamiltonian Fleur equation on a plane mapping into the target. And the idea is that you should try to use these things to define differentials and compositions. So if you have, you know, two gradient flow lines, then you can have a map U to C, which, you know, at kind of two directions asymptotes to critical points, at the other two directions asymptotes to two gradient flow lines. That makes sense if you look at this equation. And then maybe if you kind of correctly choose these thetas to depend on the different directions, or maybe you do some other prescription, there's several different ideas in literature, then you can use this sort of a type of equation to also define compositions and to get some kind of A infinity category. So this is some sort of picture where maybe imagine C and you divide it into three different sectors, and then this maybe theta depends on the sector, maybe it doesn't, and in different directions, it's sort of supposed to asymptote to gradient flow lines for different thetas. Okay. So I can talk more about this and maybe how you really would try to set this up. But I want to say some names, because none of this is really, you know, kind of, people have thought about this idea for a long time. This idea of associating a category to a complex Morse function goes at least back to Donaldson-Thomas, and like maybe to Siegel as well. And also kind of Hadis in this sort of gauge theory tradition spent some time like thinking about how to do this analytically. Separately, there's a physical proposal by Goethe Moore Witten, and then kind of a little it's sort of a little bit repackaged into a nice algebraic formalism by Concewicz-Teubelmann. And this kind of story goes into the name of like algebra of the infrared or the sort of zeta instanton equation. There's a bunch of different words. And I can tell you quite a bit, I think, about what is the current status of these ideas from like a differential geometry perspective. But one thing to keep in mind is that there should be a rigorous definition of this category, and it already exists. It's just the Fockei-Seidel category of this Lefschetz vibration. And you know, more the basic map from one to the other, well, from a critical point, you can extract a thimble. And then, you know, given two thimbles, let me draw something for a second. Of course, the number of gradient flows from here to here is the same as the intersection number of this thimble with itself. And so there's kind of some natural bijection between these morphism sets, and the usual morphisms in the Fockei-Seidel category, which is just the kind of you take one thimble, another thimble, you push it forward and you count the intersections. You know, what is the proof? Well, the thimbles are in flow line, in the kind of they're all like stable manifolds of a Morse function. You just kind of move these Morse functions to a straight line. That's the bijection. Okay. So the analysis, so this is not, there's no definite, there's no like analytical proof that you can construct the Fockei-Seidel category using these types of equations, but some partial work has been done by Hadis and also by Donghao Wang. Okay. So this is some finite dimensional story that I just told you. But the motivation to do this, give us alternative formulation besides some kind of physical motivation, is well, you want to do this with like an infinite a function on an infinite dimensional space, namely with this complex action functional. In that case, this Fleur plane equation, the zeta instanton equation, gives raw is the same as a something called a Fuder equation. So you can just take this equation and you know write it out. You kind of have seen all these formulae already in this talk. And then you arrange it using the quaternionic relations to get this. There's this annoying minus sign, which doesn't really matter. So this equation is like, you know, a natural quaternionic analog of the J-homomorphic curve equation. And it goes back to like the early 20th century. And when people started kind of, it's what you would want to do if you wanted to write down, do like quaternionic analysis. There's like Cauchy-Riemann integral, there's like Cauchy's integral formulae types things for this. Okay, so now I'm going to say a bunch of words about this equation, because it's interesting for a lot of for a lot of different reasons. So one reason that it's interesting, which is maybe the relevant kind of this is the relevant audience, so that this is the partial differential equation underlying the A twist of this 3D n equals 4 supersymmetric sigma model. And this goes back to Anselmi and Fréchet from the 90s. At least they did it for like 4D n equals 2 theory, and you can dimensionally reduce to get this result. There's other ways of driving this. It also arises as kind of limits of G2 instantons. G2 instantons bubble along something, and then what you get is the limiting behavior, if you bubble along something that is smooth, would be like a Fuder map into a moduli space of bundles, just some hypercantor manifold. It was also investigated by a bunch of symplectically flavored people, like, okay, I have their names, and they wanted to say, like, well, there's this 3D Fuder equation, there's a corresponding 4D Fuder equation where you have like four coordinates and it's just a dx, you know, plus these things. And then, you know, you build some complex with like critical points 3D solutions and differentials 4D solutions. And then, you know, this kind of is interesting. You can use this to produce interesting 4D Fuder, 3D Fuder maps perturbed by some function. But this is like one field theoretic level up. This is like a 4D field theory that they're studying rather than a 3D field theory, which is the stuff doing thing that we're studying. And then, okay, I have some more names here. So, well, let me say some more words. So there's a formal proposal, which again, I don't know, a bunch of people have vaguely thought about this, just that if you have a hyperkähler target, then you should have some kind of Fuder 2 category. Where it's like, the Fuder, there's a Hom category between two holomorphic Lagrangians, which is morally the Fockei-Seidel category of this infinite dimensional Lefschetz vibration. And then there's some compositions between these Homs. And moreover, if you apply Hochschild homology to each Hom category, you would just get the usual Fockei category for, you know, Okay, one of these symplectic forms. So maybe there's some background angle in the Foucaultic category that tells you which one you would get. But remember, the Foucaultic, again, because of this previous reason, the Foucaultic, the classical Fleury theoretic comms between these holomorphic Lagrangians are very simple. So the kind of this, the only, all these interesting extra extra differentials are really only being seen in this sort of like two categorical setting. Okay. And so this is a formal proposal, and I mean, I think physicists have thought about it. I think Ahsan Khan has been thinking about some operatic aspects of this proposal. There's some like attempts at thinking about this with like stops, use it with Gamage, Hilbert, and Maeselje, which kind of the sheaf theoretic models. I think Boisseau has thought about like relations to DT theory. Anyway, okay, this is a formal idea, and you know, I don't know, and no one told me about this, but it's an interesting formal idea to consider with a lot of problems in it. And so what we thought about is we thought about what is the analog of Fleury's theorem in this context. So I'm calling this kind of finite dimensional reduction result Fleury's theorem. So here is a statement that might be true, which is that if you have a holomorphic function on, if you have a Lefschetz vibration, a symplectic manifold, or maybe a holomorphic Lefschetz vibration, then the Foucaultic category of the holomorphic Lefschetz vibration should be equal to the Hom category between the zero section and the graph of the differential of the holomorphic function thought of as holomorphic Lagrangians in the cotangent bundle to your manifold. So this is a conjecture. I'm going to say conjecture here. And a big part of the reason why it's a conjecture is just because, you know, the only way you could try to imagine proving this is by saying, well, the left-hand side has some zeta instanton model, and then kind of like Fleur, you can sort of have a bijection between these Fleur planes in defining this sort of Foucaultic category and these Fuder maps into the cotangent bundle of M, which define these sort of categorical operations. And what we do is we establish this bijection of moduli spaces. So like given a Fleur plane, there is a Fuder map between the zero section, and the graph of the differential of this function, and vice versa. They're in bijection. So that's our project. I'll say a precise statement in a little bit. Okay. So let me tell you, this is a reasonable thing to try to do. But it has some problems. So let me give you one reason why this is a strange thing to try to say. The first problem is that the cotangent bundle of almost any manifold is not hyperkähler. It's very rare for that to happen. It's like if it's cotangent bundles of Riemann surfaces are hyperkähler. There's a few other examples, maybe G-mod B or something. But that makes it a very restrictive. It's very restrictive if you force yourself in this kind of very small setting. And so we have a partial solution to this, which is some kind of theory of taming triples. So in symplectic geometry, you can ask for, you know, a symplectic form to be compatible with an almost complex structure. Like omega, you know, dot I dot is a metric, and I pullback omega is omega. But we can also ask for not that. We could just ask for like omega this plus omega I dash this or something, maybe with a minus sign, is a metric. And there's no like, it's not preserved, but it's not I complex. The metric ends up being I complex, but the symplectic form is not. It's not preserved by I. And that's still fine. You still have like an energy identity. So there's a topological energy, which is like the integral of the symplectic form. And there's a geometric energy, which is some kind of like integrals of norms of differentials of your map. And one is upper bounded by the other. And that's what makes it for a solution. There's a lower bound in all cases, and for solutions is bound to saturated. And that's sort of what makes bubbling theory possible. And so, you know, you can do something analogous in this Fuder map context, and you just require a triple of almost complex structures and a triple of symplectic forms, which satisfy some inequality. It's not like a compatibility condition. So in this thing, I don't want to, you know, there's an integral version of this inequality, which is that the energy of a Fuder map is upper bounded by something like this. There's some breaking between the I and the J's because we're doing it for these kind of Fuder maps, which are differentials between things. So if you wanted to do Fuder maps on closed manifolds, then you would have, this would be a symmetric quantity. It would be like omega I x plus whatever plus whatever. And this inequality is weak enough that it's possible for I, j, and k to not be integrable, which is very useful. Now these taming triples exist on cotangent bundles of any symplectic manifold. Or at least any Weinstein, any Stein, they exist on the cotangent bundle of any almost of any like, yeah, I guess any Weinstein manifold. So that's useful. So that's a much larger class of cases than this case where like IJK and really integrable, and you still have energy bounds, which is very useful. And also, there's an infinite dimensional space of these taming triples. Like this inequality is an open condition at I, J, and K. And so I can perturb I, J, and K a little bit among things satisfying the quaternionic relations, and I get still a taming triple, which is probably useful for transversality results in, you know, if you ever wanted to really define any of these categories. And maybe you can just use virtual classes, but it's useful to be able to deform everything a little bit. Okay. A different problem is that this manifold that I was telling you about, M, well, it's supposed to admit a complex Morse function. So it has to be non-compact. Because, you know, a compact complex manifold probably does not admit a non-constant function. So what that tells you is that the zero section and the graph of the differential of this function are non-compact Lagrangians. Now, in symplectic Fleur homology, so it's kind of known that, okay, well, if you have compact Lagrangians, then what do you need to do? Well, you need to get Grimm of compactness, you need two things. You need like energy bounds, and you need a C0 estimate, because like you could potentially, you know, one thing you can imagine is just like you have a sphere and it just translates to the left forever. So then like, okay, the limit of those spheres is not going to be some map. You have to actually, you know that your sphere is not going to go off to infinity. And when your Lagrangians are not compact, that's not so obvious. So usually people work with like conical Lagrangians, or maybe there's some sort of Lagrangians with some kind of bounded geometry in infinity. That's a different analytical argument. The reason for this is because if you have two Lagrangians, you have like some manifold, and then you have some conical end, where the symplectic form has some nice geometry relative to this R coordinate. And then if you have a holomorphic strip with ends on the interior, then it has to be tangent to this sort of defining function somewhere here. And there's a maximal principle for this radial function whenever you have a symplectic manifold with a conical end, which then tells you that like if these endpoints are in here, then your strip actually is bounded in here. It's bounded in some compact region if the ends are bounded in this compact region. So that's necessary for Grimm of compactness. Here this strip had a boundary, so this boundary was meant to be on like a Lagrangian, which is going off to infinity. So that really, to get that estimate to work at the boundary point, the Lagrangian has to be conical, it has to be R invariant. So that's a phenomenon that happens, and it turns out that when we try to prove the sort of bijection of moduli spaces by following an analog of Fleur's argument, you also get some extra terms, which essentially arise from the non-integrability of the complex structures. So you want some extra estimate. And to do both of these things, both to deal with non-compact Lagrangians and to get this extra estimate, we've noticed there's this theory of like IJK convex functions, which is sort of analogous to the theory of, so if you have an almost complex manifold, then if you have a function on it, you can say it's convex if the Levy form of that function is like a symplectic form, it's not a degenerate. If you have a manifold admitting a triple of almost complex structures, then you can combine the Levy forms into a three form. This is a three form on X cross R3. And then you can ask for this three form to have a sign on the graphs of all Fuder maps. And this is a reasonable notion. This is the formula for the Levy form of a function with respect to a complex structure. And if you have such a function, then it satisfies a maximal principle. You know, if you have any, a map from any, if you have any Fuder map, then this function satisfies a maximum principle. when pulled back to that footer map. So it, you can use it to control, you can kind of use it to say, well, if you have a footer map with like ends in a sublevel set, then the whole thing has to lie in a sublevel set. And these functions are, there's quite a number of them. You can do similar things like the sum of two convex functions is, you know, the maximum of two convex functions is convex and so forth. And you should be able to use these sorts of functions to do surgery theory in the same way that you use these functions to do surgery theory for in Weinstein geometry or in Stein geometry. So this function, therefore, you know, if you have like a Stein domain, you can look at it. So if you have Stein manifold, they have an I convex function. So you can look at a sublevel set to get a Stein domain and then complete it. And then you can do similar things with just manifolds admitting triples of almost complex structures. And you can also define an analog of like a Lagrangian. So, you know, you can define a kind of a your manifold having a conical end, which is just if you have, has this convex function, which is has no critical points outside a compact set. And you can also define a conical Lagrangian, which is this condition, which is more or less the R invariance condition. And you can use, in this setting, you can kind of confine Fuder maps to sublevel sets, even if they have boundaries on these non-compact Lagrangians. So this is kind of just like very foundational kind of analog of sort of Weinstein manifold geometry that is happening in the setting. Okay. So let me tell you what we did. This is like the actual statement. If you have a Lefschetz vibration on a manifold, where so the manifold is, it's a little bit tricky. You know, you want W to be okay. So I'll say something coherent here. So we are going to want this function to be C2 small in the in the same way that in Fleur's theorem, this Morse function has to be C2 small. So it's a little bit unclear what it means for a holomorphic function to have, abstractly to have like a size, because there's no metric. But if it's a function on a symplectic manifold, there's a natural metric with respect to which you can measure the size. However, for your typical symplectic manifold like CN and your typical holomorphic function like a polynomial, of course this function is going to be unbounded. You know, its derivatives are all going to blow up at infinity. So you have two options to try to make sense of what it means for this function to be C2 small, or alternatively, for the graph of the differential of this function to be near your original manifold. The first one is you can like just cut off infinity and say, well, I have a Lefschetz vibration in a compact manifold. That's okay, we can work with that. A different option is you say, you know, the differential of your function is one outside a compact set. So what this means is that geometrically, so the gradient, not the grade, the size, the gradient. But that means that geometrically, outside of a compact set in C, this vibration is a Riemannian submersion. And if you have any symplectic manifold, you can all, and kind of a symplectic Lefschetz vibration, you can always find an almost complex structure which makes it a Riemannian submersion outside of a compact set. Now this condition is maybe kind of sounds strong, but it pops up in Hades's work. It's like very useful for you get a maximum principle for these Fleur planes this way very easily. So we end up kind of using the geometry that this condition imposes on these Lagrangians in order to study some of sort of what could happen if these maps escape off to infinity horizontally. So then the precise statement of the theorem is that for any small epsilon, there's a triple ijk, which depend on tau, on the cotangent bundle to M, which I'm going to call X. And this triple is like tamed. So there are energy bounds. We satisfy the quaternionic relations for each tau. And there's a bijection between Fleur planes mapping to M, which are things satisfying the equation I wrote down, with the asymptotics given by, in one direction, you asymptote to a critical point of W. And then in the other direction, you asymptote to gradient flow lines. That's on one side. And on the other side, it's the Fuder maps into this cotangent bundle. So with respect to this triple of almost complex structures, so these complex structures depend on the point in the domain, they depend on tau, but that's okay, that's normal. Like if you have J holomorphic curves, the J can depend on the point in your Riemann surface. There's no particular challenge there analytically. And you know, this is, I'm just writing this Fuder equation again here, just so you see what it looks like. And the asymptotics are basically the asymptotics of the Fleur planes, but you cross everything with an interval. So in two of the directions, like here, where we did s to infinity, so we also take s to infinity, we go to intersections of the two Lagrangians, which correspond to critical points. At the finite, so the domain, sorry, let me just make this clear. I said I cross with an interval. So before I had a map from R2, now I have a map from R2 cross 0, 1. So this has two finite boundaries, the 0 boundary, the 1 boundary. These lie on the Lagrangians. Now, in the other two directions, in one of the directions, you go to intersection points of the two Lagrangians, which correspond to critical points. And in the other directions, you go to, so that's this thing. And the second thing is you go to solutions to the J-holomorphic curve equation, right? Now, those things by Fleur's theorem were actually, so this J tau is the J tau that Fleur uses. And so these things are in bijection with these gradient flows. So that's sort of what it is. So if you have a Fleur plane with some asymptotics, kind of maybe like this, then you cross this with 0, 1, and you get, okay, let me, I'm just going to draw this. You get like a Fuder, so you it's a map from a three manifold. So this is L0 and L1. Going to draw these guys. So these guys become some kind of strip. And then at infinity here, you have some kind of critical point. And these become intersections. So these L's somewhere in this direction, these L's actually intersect. You get some kind of, I guess, pillowcase maybe. Okay, so this is the interior of like a box. There's an L0, there's an L1 on the bottom side, and these are some strips. Okay, so that's sort of how you should think of this Fuder map sitting in the cotangent bundle. Okay, so maybe this is the first time I have actually gotten to the point where I can explain something about the proof. So if you guys have any questions, you should feel free to ask them because I think I actually have the time. I usually totally ran out of time on this talk, but maybe I've given it enough times now that it's become very efficient in my head. Okay, so yeah, so feel free to ask questions, but I'll tell you about the proof. So, well, first of all, we need to get these I, J, and K. So when I choose a metric on M, in fact, there is a metric on M coming from I, right, and omega. So a metric on M splits the tangent bundle to the tangent bundle because there's a Levi-Civita connection on M, and that distribution gives me the splitting. I'm sorry, the tangent bundle to the cotangent bundle. And now using that splitting, you can write down three complex structures. These are sort of standard, almost complex structures in a cotangent bundle. So this I, which is just, you know, the action of I on the tangent bundle and the cotangent bundle. That's integrable if the original I was integrable. There's J. That's the kind of given like this. This is the J that is lives on a cotangent bundle associated to a metric on the base. That's the J that Fleur uses. And this K, which is I times J. These things are you know, they're, so J is usually almost complex. It's very hard for it to be integrable. If you have U from mapping from R2 to M, so I mean, the way this is like Hyperkähler is, right, like if the base has some very special geometry, then J ends up becoming integrable. Something much stronger than like a Kähler geometry, because J really comes from the metric. Now what you want to do is you want to define some flow on the total space of X. And so, well, if you have this real part of W, you can pull it back to X, and you can use the canonical symplectic form on the cotangent bundle to get a Hamiltonian flow of phi. And if you have a map little u from R2 to M, then you can define a map big U from, you know, pat kind of finite interval across R2 to X, given by this formula. Okay? So you just flow it along the Hamiltonian flow. And you can also look at the flow images of these original I, J, and K under this Hamiltonian flow. So that defines you I tau, J tau, and K tau. I've told you exactly what they are. And you can check that if You solves. I really hope you guys aren't seeing yourselves here. If you solves, if little u solves this Fleur-Plane equation or the Zeta-Instanton equation, then big U solves the corresponding Fudermap equation. Okay. So that's the map one way, and you have to show that it's a bijection onto its image. And the way you do that is you take big U and you write it as a two maps. One is the projection to the base, and the other one is a section of the pullback of the projection to the base to the cotangent bundle. And you know, if the Fudder equation splits into two parts, it's like a dz part and a dz bar part, essentially. And you kind of do something that's very similar to what Fleur does. You combine these two parts, you like apply, use one to substitute terms into the other, and you integrate, you do a clever integration by parts. And in the end, you get an estimate that looks like this. So I've written out the key estimate. So these are like taus. So these are, so xi here is this kind of, you know, pull, but t star m has a complex structure I. So you can look at like covariant derivatives and 0-1 parts of covariant derivatives, because it also has a metric. And that you get this estimate. So what you want to show is you want to show that xi is zero. The second that xi is zero, u is a solution to a Fleur-Plane equation. And the basic difference, so the epsilon is here. This and the completely analogous epsilon, where you kind of uncomplexify everything, happens in Fleur's proof. And there is something that doesn't happen in Fleur's proof, which is this kind of extra term. And this extra term is zero if I was integrable. But again, as I said, you kind of don't really want to assume that. So we control this term by writing down a convex function on the cotangent bundle. So the point is that if you look at if your base, if you ha if you if your base was like some total space of a Lefschetz vibration, then you know it's got like a plur the I can have a plurisubharmonic function for it. So maybe call that plurisubharmonic function rho m to r. And then you can take norm xi squared plus the pullback with respect to the projection to the base of rho. So there's a norm fiber plus kind of Fleur subharmonic size of the base. This is an IJK convex function. And the two Lagrangians are essentially conical with respect to this function because of this grad I, grad m, grad w equals one condition. This Riemannian subversion condition implies some nice asymptotic geometry at infinity. And so, well, okay. We know that the if we have these two Lagrangians, and we know that the Fleur trajectories are all like in sublevel sets, so sublevel sets of this function, in part because an IJK convex function is I convex for every I in Twister space. And now we can use this function to actually kind of because the n, so now the n's are in a sublevel set by the classical result, and so the whole thing is a sub, in a sublevel set by this kind of new convexity result. And that tells you that in particular xi is small, because if you look at the sublevel sets of this thing, they're kind of like rectangles. Okay. And then once this is sufficiently small and epsilon is sufficiently small, you actually conclude that xi is zero and the 0-1 part of xi is zero, so therefore the d tau u is zero by the Fudermap equation, and therefore this is the image of a Fleur plane. Okay, cool. So that's the analysis, and that's maybe the core content. But well, let me say something else, which is interesting, which I've kind of been mentioning to people. So the Fudder thing should be some two categories. You should have Homs between holomorphic Lagrangians. You have composition of Homs. It should be like functors, Fudder L0 L1, tensor Fudder L1 L2 to Fudder L0 L2. So now you can imagine doing some kind of Hamiltonian Fleur argument, flow argument. So you know the way you perturb, well, okay, you can perturb a Fudder equation by you know, the gradient of a function, maybe the gradient of a holomorphic function, and then that sort of still makes sense. That goes back to Holick and Salomon. But you should well, therefore get, if you kind of imagine doing that argument, the Fudder-Homm between the graph of the differential of one holomorphic function, the graph of the differential of another holomorphic function, is the Homm between the zero section and the graph of the differential of the difference. Or, in other words, that you would get a composition like this in the Fudder category, which, if you believe our conjecture, would give you an operation like this, whenever everything made sense. So there's lots of reasons why you might not get this operation. Like maybe there's food or bubbling. I could say something about that. Food or bubbling is not super well characterized. In this setting where you have an IJK convex function, footer maps can only bubble along points, and no one knows how they bubble. So it's an interesting question to show that they can't bubble in this IJK convex function setting. It's, maybe they do. In the case where the target is flat, they don't bubble. That's sort of true by some easy estimate. Anyway, there's many reasons why something might not work, or maybe you can't choose all pairs of W1 and W2 because they need to have some compatible asymptotic geometry. But on a very formal level, that tells you is that you get a composition operation between Foucault-Seidel categories of different superpotentials on the same manifold. And if you look at like C star to the n and Laurent polynomials, then by mirror symmetry, these are mirror Titoric varieties. And now you can do something where, like, if you have the product of you have two toric varieties, you take their product and quotient by the diagonal action. So alternatively, if you think about like line bundles of on toric varieties as piecewise linear function, the fan, you can like superimpose the fans to subdivide the fans and then add the functions to get a map. That's sort of one that's more directly compatible with like kind of old stories about homological mirror symmetry for toric varieties. And then you get an operation like this in that setting using 2D mirror symmetry. And this maybe could be thought of some aspect of 3D mirror symmetry for the cotangent bundle to C star to the n, since that, well, I guess like maybe toric varieties are kind of related to, point mod T star, point mod C star to the n. I don't really know. So you can ask what's like the KRS category. So there's supposed to be some 2D mirror symmetry statement where this KRS2 category, which is not so well defined, but whose basic objects are like holomorphic Lagrangians and Homs. Well, you look at one holomorphic Lagrangian over the graph of the other, and then locally that's a differential of a function. So maybe you look at matrix factorizations of that, and you can compose those by some convolution argument, or alternatively, in the case of just kind of the analog of this thing that I said, is like you take W1 plus W2 on the product, and you kind of do some pullback along the diagonal. It's a local model for the composition in the KRS2 category. And you would expect that under 3D mirror symmetry, the sort of category of the two category of A type brains exchange the two category B type brains. So this Fooder 2 category should be exchanged with this KRS2 category, in as much as you can make sense of any of these words. And in this case, okay, this kind of really looks like that, I think, on some formal level. If you can convince yourself that the Fooder, the KRS2 category should be related of T star point mod C star should be related to toric varieties. And then, you could try to think about a different case. There's like C to the n, and there's you look at like invertible polynomials or whatever ADE polynomials, and then that is under Berglund-Hoopsch mirror symmetry, mirror to matrix factorizations of the kind of transpose invertible polynomial, and you could try to use this KRS operation to build compositions for those, and maybe that's related to sort of so C star to the n and C n are flat, so it's sort of those are settings where it's quite plausible that quite a lot of this Fooder category really exists. So that's sort of one interesting way of taking, and okay, I said there's okay, so like composition operations should maybe count more complicated Fooder maps, and you can imagine some adiabatic limit theorem where they become like Fleur plane trees in some way. So you can use symplectic geometers can start thinking about how this might work. Yeah, but so this is a little bit intriguing to me. Like, when can you construct this operation on Foucault-Seidel categories? I think there is like some prospects for finding relatively general symplectic constructions. Okay, so I'm just going to say a few things. So I think this is fun because somehow 3D mirror symmetry has had like a lot of algebraic development that's very rich. And I guess people have studied some of the PDE that come out of it, like these generalized Seiberg-Witten equations and so forth. But there hasn't really been kind of too much work on the sort of intersection between the partial differential equations approach and this kind of more like rich categorical structure. And I think that from the perspective of someone who likes partial differential equations, you can use this categorical structure to ask kind of natural geometric questions, like when do you get an energy bound? And that, might impact like what categorical structure do you really get? And it also leads you to some kind of interesting geometric settings. Like we came up with this theory of convex functions, which is a very nice thing. It's very satisfying. I claim that if you have an IJK manifold equipped with a convex function, then you should think of this as a quaternionic Weinstein domain. So for example, I think one can prove that they have quarter dimensional handle body type. So there's, you know, you can start asking natural geometry questions. Is every quaternionic Weinstein domain deformation equivalent to the cotangent bundle to a Weinstein domain? That's like something that kind of a very classical simplified topologist might find satisfying. Alternatively, if you can ever leave this like integrable realm, then you can start asking much harder questions. Like, do there exist these like holomorph? There's not a lot of holomorphic Lagrangians. I keep asking people, give me your most interesting one. And they give me things which are very singular. They're like, ah, yeah, look at the nil cone in Hitchin moduli space. And I'm like, great. I, as a differential geometer, am going to struggle with that. You know, once you kind of weaken all these conditions, you can start trying to do surgeries. You can try to build stranger examples. I also think the sort of, it's possible to use these more formal things to kind of get categorical statements in kind of other settings where maybe the whole food or two category has not been defined or understood. There's some real analytical issues, but if you believe it, you can get something a little more down to earth. And finally, there's some kind of interesting question, which is like, how do you wrap Fluter maps? So, you know, you should have sort of, it's very important, like, you know, maybe you want to stay like T star G mod B, okay? And then maybe there's this like special thing given by these, you know, you have this C star action, and then you get these guys, I don't know, these like conical Lagrangians, which everybody loves. And then you want to like stop the thing at this guy. And then this would maybe categorify your favorite construction. You have like, you know, the Foucault category of this thing should be whatever is constructible sheaf category, maybe it's some category O, and then you kind of want to go one level up from that. So this is some natural way to try to do that. And there's some real like actual geometry underlying this. Because of course there are functions, these things are defined by some functions, maybe, and then like, you know, you can try to deform the Fluter map equation in the appropriate way by kind of adding to this complex action functional another complex function, which is a complex Hamiltonian. And that starts, you know, that starts being a very interesting kind of thing where there's like the category theory can help you do some concrete differential geometry and vice versa. It's hard to do those without this perspective. Okay, so I have nothing else to say at the moment, although I can rant about like questions and kind of directions forever. So I hope you guys enjoyed what I have to say. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Everybody, let's thank Simone. Sorry, clapping quietly because I have other people in the house.
Anyway. That's what the reaction emojis are for.
Oh. Wait, we got questions?
I mean, I have questions for the experts in the room, but...
That also works if we want to do a reverse question session. I just wanted to say that I appreciated seeing this proof. It was very, very nice. It was like nice to see how that sort of thing is done.
Yeah. Yeah, and in the end, you have to prove an estimate. You can't avoid, you know, the focus of analysts on like, you know, you need to show me the estimate is often, it's justified. From their perspective, you know, to prove an estimate, you usually have to do some actual geometric construction. Sort of, you have to come up with a convex function or something. We spent a very long time trying to write down a single convex function on the cotangent bundle, because it's hard to check that the differentials of a function satisfy an inequality. I kind of don't, you know, I started thinking about this stuff because I wanted to think about 3D mirror symmetry. And then I, you know, there's all these enumerative computations by Kunkov et al. And then they're all about these equivariant Gromov-Witten invariants. And then I was a bit confused because somehow when we study Foucault categories, we don't usually use those. Like, it's kind of the equivariant Foucault category. There's some confusion about equivariant mirror symmetry, I think, still. And I was just trying, and then there were people who were like, wait, if you don't have this equivariant stuff, then everything vanishes. And then quantum cohomology is not interesting, and Lagrangian four cohomology is kind of trivial. So then I was just trying to figure out, like, what am I supposed to do? I want to count these curves somehow. And then somehow, you know, you realize that maybe this is the way to count everything. in some very elaborate way. But then I didn't understand. I kind of thought, well, I don't know any. I've learned nothing about 3D mirror symmetry. All I've learned is about this like interesting equation. And it turned out that it actually is the sort of this PDE underlying this field theory, which I didn't know until like a few weeks ago. I don't really, you know, yeah, it's, I don't kind of understand the, like, there are all these strange gaps between the sort of perspective of people in gauge theory and FLIR theory and the sort of physical perspective. And I've been just trying to look for the places where there's some tractable thing to be done, where the analysis is not hopeless.
Have you thought about trying to do like the cotangent fiber, like do things in the, like, I've asked you about wrapping before, but yeah. I think maybe I gave you a too complicated example of wrapping. Like maybe a better example just would have been like in the cotangent bundle to see start of the n.
Yeah.
Can you do the cotangent fiber to one?
Or like, you mean like the com from the cotangent fiber to itself or something?
Yeah. And get something like local systems on like the loop space. I mean, in this case, it's pretty stupid because it's contractible, but maybe, yeah. I mean, so the loop space is just a union of contractible things, but maybe.
I mean, you could try to do this on a more interesting cotangent bundle. And certainly cotangent bundles of Riemann surfaces are pretty interesting. I don't want to say something that's not correct at the moment. I kind of don't understand where, like, this Fuder equation is studied by physicists. You know, I showed it to, I asked Taubes about this, and he was like, oh yes, I didn't know this was called the Fuder equation. It was like, he tried to use this equation to, I think, prove something about exotic R4s once.
Question. So physicists don't like the sigma model case.
Yes.
They really like gauge theory. So if you study gauge theory, you might get some equation involving, what's it called again?
Yeah, there are these generalized Hebberg-Witten equations.
Yeah. But do you do that?
We have not thought about that. In part because, all we did is we proved, so like the main thing, the challenge is that, you know, somebody has to understand the bubbling theory of these higher dimensional equations. And people keep not understanding it. Now, for the gauge theory equation, so yeah, I haven't thought about the categorical aspects of these generalized Hebberg-Witten equations. And I haven't in particular thought about like what is the boundary of the analysis? There might very well be some adiabatic limit theorem that one could try to prove. Like maybe you have C to the N equipped with some action, and then T star C to the N equipped with some action. There's some, I'm just like, well, all we do is we prove this kind of adiabatic limit theorem. You could try to find an analog of it for the gauged equations. I think that's interesting.
And you know the equations in this case, yeah, it would just be like the 2D Witten equation or whatever.
Yeah. I have not done that. That's a reasonable question. Some of it might be tractable because the 2D Witten equation is okay.
There's a lot of literature. I'm not sure if you're going to be able to bring anything to mind, but you know the way Sasha does stuff, the Afanasian-Grassmannian appears.
Yeah.
This is like to view that as solution to the monopole equations, and it's the same state.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure out what is exactly the situation there. This is like the kind of fully open string sector. You should decategorify this twice to get these BFN rings, right, in this gauge theory setting. You should take
It's a Hilbert space on the two sphere, right? So.
Right. So I did. So to get something on the two sphere, I want to take like the closed string category, which is something on the circle, and then take Hochschild homology of that again, which is.
Okay.
So there's different ways of taking Hochschild homology. Once you have a two category, there's different ways of taking Hochschild homology. You can take like Hochschild homology of each Hom, or you can take some other thing, which is like the thing that the thing that it should be assigned to the circle. That should be given in terms of like some Fuder type thing. And then you can take Hochschild homology of that category, which should give you this BFN ring.
The cohomology.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, but anyway, whatever.
The thing, my understanding is that for the kind of there's this relation between these affine Grassmannian slices and these monopole equations that kind of gives you the right like map. But you have to look at like monopoles on R3 minus 0, which is a bit different from the usual Fleur theoretic setting where you look at like something on S2. So that's already some confusion. Like if you look at Nakajima's paper, he kind of is like, oh, there's no flat connections on S2. That's true. You can gauge away the Bolgamolny term if you actually look at things on S2, but you have to set up it a bit differently. But then I think it's still open question to show that you can compute the BFN ring from some kind of Fuder equation, or some kind of generalized Hedberg-Witten equation on, like, maybe it's S3, maybe it's going to be, like, R3 minus 3 points or something. There's some, like, actual analysis question. I've been trying to make sure I know, I've been trying to figure out that, like, I'm convinced that I have the right analysis question, because some of the times when people have tried to write down analytical counterparts to these things, they've written down things which are at least misled. But yeah, it's plausible that you can like prove some correct, you know, if you set up the generalized Hedberg-Witten equation correctly, then there'll be some Kobayashi-Hitchin correspondence to this like double, to this, whatever they call it, this,
Raviola.
Yeah, with a Raviola. That's kind of a, it's very natural to look for the right setup so that that's true, so that you would compute the closed string variant from the K-theory. I think that's still open. There's also the possibility of doing like the, you know, trying to think about these things associated to a circle, then an adiabatic limit theory argument might actually let you relate this, that category to some purely Morse theoretic category, which would then be some sheaves on some loop space or something. So that's not impossible, I think. As the kind of analytic problem. What?
The kind of category that Justin studies with Tudor.
Well, Justin's, yeah, I think, guess so.
But we didn't manage to do it in a, like a Fuhr theoretic way, right? We had to use D modules or whatever, but like the way Tudor and I had originally tried to do it is write down maps from a circle, into your, you know, manifold and then write down, basically this exact same superpotential that Simone wrote down. But we couldn't get enough objects. And anyway, so I've been asking Simone about how we could possibly fix it. It has something to do with the fact that like T star C isn't compact. And so you have to like do something extra.
Yeah, there's all this like story where you're supposed to wrap things. And so somehow the differential geometry of the wrapping should tell you how to do the algebra correctly. Yeah, I think there's other questions in this area, which are probably natural PD questions. And I've been trying to narrow down on the right ones because it's hard to get anyone to tell you anything coherent. Okay. So if there are no more questions, I mean, I'm perfectly happy, but thank you. I'm happy to answer as long as anyone is curious. Yeah, I'd still like to convince myself that this like Raviola, like what's the Kobayashi-Hitchin correspondence for the Raviola, but that's like a coherent question because I kind of...
I mean, I think like this thing that you sent me, this Hay-Walpolsky paper, I think they do it just for very special map or just for a very special representation. They just do it for the adjoint representation.
I see. Okay.
So I think that was actually like the right like analytic, analytic
that's
setup.
Interesting.
You just have to change out the, like they just specialized like what representation you were looking at.
Okay.
I wonder if there's one in general for like a three manifold with a transverse holomorphic foliation. Because then, you know, the equations BFN use work in that context. It's just a bundle which is holomorphic in one direction, mm-hmm. not in the other. And then you want that to match with solutions of the Bolgamolny equations.
I've seen these. I mean, it's true that, you know, when you write down this, like, this Fuder equation, you know, of course, even in that case, you should of course think of this. What is this? This is an R2. This is a 0-1. So a lot of what we do is really like sigma across 0-1, where sigma is a Riemann surface, right? And it's like covariant in that kind of the sigma direction. So you can like prove energy bounds in kind of that setting. So I do think these transverse these holomorphic foliations do naturally pop up. Whenever you think about this, but yeah, maybe. Sorry. So, maybe I didn't quite understand the question.
The question was like the equations BFN use should naturally be thought of as describing bundles on THF manifolds.
Yeah.
and then you want to show that it was a Kobayashi-Hitchin correspondence in that generality. That might be nice.
I see. Okay. Yeah, that would be interesting to look at.
It would include the bubble. I mean, the issue, of course, is not compact, but the bubble is naturally thought of as a GHF three manifold, like a cylinder with a point removed.
Oh, you're saying because you think of it like so, like R3 minus a point is like trans, is like sphere.
That's yeah, the whole issue. Yes, and it's holomorphic, and then they're glued together by the flat connection along there.
I see. Okay. Yeah, maybe that's the right, maybe that language would, it would be, a lot of this challenge for me has been kind of finding the right language. And once you find the right language, a lot of results become easier. Like you're like, oh, how do I confine these things? You're like, aha, convex functions, kind of very simple. Maybe it will end up being useful. That would be great, I think. There's also, what was I going to say? I don't remember. Oh, right. So there's the question, of course, there's a different question of, and which I don't really understand any physicists have thought about it. You know, when you have this Fuder map, like if energy concentrates here, then it develops some kind of singularity. And this singularity is totally not characterized. So maybe people don't, maybe they don't exist in these physics settings. If you kind of blow up here, then you have like a two sphere around it. And what it looks like is something which kind of the formal guess as to what the geometry there is that you're like, you're bubbling off a section of the twister sphere. So that's a bit, it's kind of a strange computation that one can do. It's sort of the same way you derive all the other bubbling results. And so I don't really understand like how these Fuder maps kind of interact with like sections of twister spheres and vice versa. There's other calls to all kinds of other phenomena. Like, you know, if you have these two holomorphic Lagrangians, L0 and L0, well, let's use one holomorphic Lagrangian, then you can think of it as like sitting over each point of the twister circle. And then you can look at sections of the twister bundle with boundary on this thing. And you can try to evaluate them at a point. And that each time you get like an element of Fleur homology group. And of course, this element is going to be preserved by the monodromy of this Fleur homology group. This is all like I've decategorified everything quite a lot. But now there's this Concevich-Soibelman story. So this Fleur homology group should really be like, you know, the D module, right? And so what I've produced for you is I've produced for you a canonical flat section of the D module out of counting sections of the twister bundle, the north half of a twister sphere. I have no idea what this holomorphic function satisfying a differential equation is. I would really like somebody to tell me. It seems presumably it has something to do with like all these complicated wall crossing things, but I kind of, you know, this sort of enumerative geometry is beyond my pay grade usually. And then there's all these, yeah, so really understanding how this kind of stuff interacts with like these extra bubbling terms. I think there's a lot of strange algebraic structure, which hasn't really been kind of imagined yet. And which if there was a kind of a clear, like there's a setting where you could see it algebraically, it would be very interesting, I think, to differential geometers, because you could try to guess like what we should prove. The problem is getting the ansatzes right often. Okay. That's just another sort of comment about the phenomenology of these maps. Yeah, I think it's quite possible to get analysts to resolve some of these questions once one gives them enough motivation, which has been something that I've been trying to do for the past like month and a half with some success. So I'm hoping that some of this sort of analytic situation gets cleared up in the fall. And so, especially since people will be kind of hanging out in Berkeley, but one has to find problems which are like analytically really compelling. So otherwise nobody will like work on them. So, and they're like tractable. So they don't, you don't have to solve some really hard problem, like show smoothness of the bubbling locus or something, which so far there have been, like, so this is like one of the big obstructions is like, no one knows that if you have a limit of PDE that bubbles along something, that it bubbles along something smooth, even generically. And there's no method for proving this, except maybe the Ricci flow. People have done it in a few cases. So that means that one has to either exclude bubbles a priori or like, which in many of these cases, maybe they do get excluded by these adiabatic limit arguments. Like for us, we know that our Frieder maps don't bubble because they come from Fleur planes, and we know how Fleur planes bubble. So, yeah.
So any more questions? Okay, why don't we thank Simone again.
All right, thank you.